there's a new form of free, there's a new form of gratis that is not a choice. There's 20th century free and there's 21st century free, and they are very different. Let's start with 20th century free. I'll move past this. So 20th century free started with this guy. His name is King Gillette. And he, in 1900, he was 40 years old. He was an inventor, but he was a failed inventor. He was working as a salesman for a cork bottle cap company, and which was exactly as fun as it sounds. And he was trying to get to take one last shot at starting a company. He went to his boss at the cork bottle cap company, and he said, what is your advice for me? What should I make? And the boss at the cork bottle cap company said, you should make something that people throw away. Which, if you're in the cork bottle cap industry, makes perfect sense. You throw away bottle caps. The nice thing when people throw things away is they tend to buy new ones. So he was thinking about what he could make that people would throw away. And at the time, when you shaved, you used something called a straight razor or a cutthroat razor. And you would sharpen it with a leather belt. And eventually, it really wouldn't hold an edge anymore. You couldn't sharpen it anymore, and it was just dull. And then it would cut your face, and it was really not very nice at all. One morning, as he was shaving the lower half of his face, as you can see, he thought, you know what would be great is if we had a disposable razor. And so he spent 5 years working with a metallurgist trying to invent the disposable razor. It required a certain kind of stainless steel that was thin and cheap and could hold an edge. And eventually they developed it. And then they had another problem. And this other problem was that no one understood what a disposable razor was or why they would want one. They needed to introduce the concept of disposable razors. Now, you have to understand this is 1900. There wasn't disposable anything in 1900. You know, things were, you know, goods that you purchased were treasured and repaired. The idea of disposable products was completely radical. So he needed to find a way to introduce disposable products. And he did it with some very clever advertising. First of all, he put his face on every package, and so King Gillette became very famous. Then he did something which was completely unprecedented, or almost unprecedented at the time, which was giving away one product to sell another. He gave away the razor to sell the blades. And initially, he gave them away to hand them out on the street. He gave them to banks in the thousands, and then the banks would give them to their customers as part of a save and shave campaign. Very effective. Then when World War I started, he gave millions of them to the army to give to the servicemen, and the soldiers would come back from the war with the understanding what a disposable razor is and wanting it. And that is how he built demand for his blades. What you do when you're in a razor and blades model, which is now very conventional, is that you basically trade payment now for payment later. You trade a point of sale to an ongoing revenue stream, a subscription or an annuity. It's a good, if you lose money now to make money back later, you shift spending over time. Now, what's important to note about this is that it's still the same consumer paying. You will pay for your blades. You will pay for your blades, maybe not the first blade, but you will pay for the next blade. This idea of free being something that you will ultimately pay for came out of the razor and blades model. And today we see it everywhere. In the United States, you can get a cell phone for free, but you pay for the minutes. You can get a DVR, a TiVo for free, but you pay for your cable subscription, etc. Not a new economic model. And you will pay. You will pay. It comes out of one pocket. Not one pocket, but comes out of another. You know, doesn't come out of this pocket, comes out of that pocket. You don't pay now, you pay later. It is basically just a marketing device. So that's one kind of free. 20th century free. There was another form of 20th century free, which is advertising. Advertising was the original form of free. Now, in advertising, you get things like radio is free to air, television is free to air. The reason this is free is a third party is paying for it. This third party is the advertiser. In economics, it's called a two-sided market. And basically, the advertiser pays for the content to be free to the consumer. The consumer then has to pay in the form of their attention to watch the ad. Based on the influence of that ad, they will then buy the product, and the money goes full circle. So once again, you're probably going to pay sooner or later. You will pay both of your time when you're watching the ad, and you will pay eventually with your money in the higher prices for the product to pay for the marketing costs. Not a new form of economics. But that's 20th century economics. Let's talk about the new form. I'm going to introduce the third form of economics by showing you a picture of a signing ceremony of a nuclear power plant in 1954. As you can see, the future was very bright. This was an optimistic time. This was the beginning of the space age. This was a time when technology was considered an exciting thing which was going to make our lives better. This was the penicillin and modern medicine, plastics, chemicals, the Green Revolution. There was the space age, it was the beginning of the information age, and it was the beginning of the nuclear age. A guy named Louis Strauss, who was the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, famously said in 1954 that nuclear power would bring about an age when electricity would become too cheap to meter. He was wrong. He was wrong for lots of reasons. Things like Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, waste disposal, regulatory issues, etc. Nuclear power turned out to be about the same prices as coal, sometimes even more expensive than coal. But imagine if he had been right. Just think for a moment. How would the world have been different if electricity had in fact been too cheap to meter? We would have had an electron economy. Not just the lighting and the heating, some of which we already do today, but imagine if you could desalinate water at no cost. Remember, electricity is an input into every aspect of our economy. Electricity touches every part of our world. If an input, a fundamental input into the economy, becomes too cheap to meter, the world is a different place. If you could desalinate water at no cost, that means that you could irrigate huge portions of the country at no cost. You could take salt water and turn it to fresh water whenever you wanted. Now, when you look at the inputs to agriculture, you have sun, which is free. You have air, which is free. I've just made water free. Pretty much all you now have is fertilizer and labor. Agriculture would become very cheap, and you'd have more of it. You now have an abundance economy of agriculture, and you could, for example, grow biofuels. You have all the food you needed, and with the excess land and inputs, you could grow biofuels, and maybe we would never have gotten stuck on fossil fuels. Maybe we would not have gotten stuck on oil and natural gas, and maybe we wouldn't have climate change as a problem today. That's how electricity too cheap to meter might have changed the world. So here's the good news. We today have three technologies every bit as important as electricity that touch every bit as much of the economy as electricity, and they are becoming too cheap to meter. The first one is the one you're probably most familiar with. This is computer processing. You're familiar with Moore's Law. Moore's Law says that every 2 years, the power of a microprocessor will double. And this has been true for now 50 years. Every 2 years, the number of transistors you can put on a chip doubles. And that means that basically that the processor in your computer will become twice as powerful next every 2 years and forevermore. We understand Moore's Law very well, but the economic corollary of Moore's Law was not as well understood. This guy here is Carver Mead. Carver Mead was a professor of semiconductor research at Caltech in California. He looked at the economic implication of Moore's Law. Now, when something becomes twice as powerful every 2 years for the same price, that means that a given unit of power becomes half as expensive every 2 years. Now, if you think about that from an individual transistor, that means that the individual transistor will go from $100 to $50 to $25 to $14, to $7, to $3, etc., that every 2 years it will fall in price by one half. And what Karamine realized is that when something gets cheaper by half every 2 years, you need to treat it differently. What you need to do is you need to waste it. And so what he preached was this line. He said, waste is good. He said you should waste transistors. And his students had no idea what he was talking about. Now, how is he waste transistors? I mean, waste is a bad thing, surely. Waste is wasteful. Waste is profligate. Waste is irresponsible. And Harvey said, I don't know how you would waste transistors, but I know that the economic imperative of Moore's law is that you must waste transistors. Because we are treating transistors as if they are scarce, but they are not. They are abundant. We are treating transistors as if they are expensive, but they are not. They are cheap, and they're getting cheaper. If switches from scarcity to abundance, the only smart thing to do is to exploit it and to treat it as if it was abundant, and that means wasting it. This is Alan Kay. He was a researcher at Xerox PARC around the time, and I think he was the first person to really figure out how to waste transistors in a really smart way. He looked at the computing paradigm of the 1970s and saw what many others had seen is just how inefficient it really was. In the 1970s, computers were mainframes. And mainframes were very big, expensive machines that were put in glass rooms that were locked. And the only people who could get to the mainframe computer were the IT guys. And the only way you could get your program to run on the computer, on the mainframe computer, was to get it by the IT guy. And the way you got your software through the IT guys was to convince the IT guys that your software did what they thought software should do. That means it should do something that's important to the business. It should not crash the computer. It should be efficient. It should focus its processing demands on core computational functions. It should be software as the IT guys see it. And one thing you should never do is waste any of your processing on the input to the software. The software should just run on the CPU and then stop. And if you pass that test, if you convince the IT guys that your software was what they considered important, they would take your punch cards in the glass door, in the slot in the glass window, and 2 days later they would give you your error statements, because of course it wouldn't run. And 2 days after that, you'd do it again. And that was a very frustrating and unfortunate experience. That is what happens when the IT guys control the computing resources. That's what happens when computers are expensive. And what Alan Kay realized is that a really good way to waste transistors would be to take computing away from the IT guys. And he did that by drawing pictures on the screen. This cartoon, which became this cartoon, is a great way to waste transistors. What he did is he wasted transistors by making computers easier to use. He wasted transistors by doing animations with windows and icons and mice and the graphical user interface, and he did that not because it did any particularly important computing work, but because it made computers accessible to the rest of us. And today, we all have computers in our pockets, we have computers in our homes, computers are everywhere. This picture, I believe, should be on every cubicle wall in Silicon Valley. This is the world's first home computer. It is the 1962 Neiman Marcus catalog. Neiman Marcus is a department store in America. And this is the Honeywell kitchen computer. There are a couple things the IT guys got right, and one very big thing they got wrong. The things they got right is they understood the technical side of Moore's law. They understood that computers would someday be small enough to be in a home. They understood that computers would someday be cheap enough to be in a home, although this one cost $10,000. They understood that computers might even be stylish, and I think this one is a bit stylish. What they didn't understand about computers is why anybody would want one. They could not figure out why anyone would want a computer in their home. And so they convened focus groups and panels, and they sat in boardrooms with whiteboards, and they thought very hard about what someone might possibly do with a computer in their home. And in the end, the only thing they could think of was recipe card management. And so this kitchen computer, as you can see, has a built-in cutting board. So that the housewife could do what they thought she would want to do, which is, it's very amusing, by the way, this computer has no screen, and the only way you could input is with toggle switches. So you would input a command in hexadecimal via toggle switches, and then it would produce a result in hexadecimal on a display, in numeric characters. And somehow you were supposed to convert that into a recipe. I'm not sure how. Anyway. They thought the only thing they could think of was recipe card management, and it is very interesting that when Alan Kay wasted transistors on making computers easier to use, and in fact we did all get computers in our homes, we found a multitude of things to do with computers. We invented all sorts of things: the web, video games, you know, application software, email, IM, you know, you name it. What's interesting is that the one thing we don't do with computers is recipe card management. And so the lesson from that is that the IT guys, the technology establishment's job is not to figure out what technology is for. Their job is to make technology cheap and easy and ubiquitous, to put it in the hands of us, and then we will tell the technologists what technology is for. And the reason we can do that better than they can is that we are all different. We all have different needs, we have different ideas, we live in different worlds. And, you know, and that we will figure out how to fit technology into our own lives. And because there are lots of us, we will all come up with different answers of what technology is for. And the web was created by putting technology in the hands of individuals. And it was not created by the, you know, by the web steering committee. The infrastructure of the web was created by the web steering committee. The content of the web and how we use it today was invented by us. So that's what 3 can do. When technology gets very, very cheap, it becomes ubiquitous. It becomes cheap enough that all of us can have it. Over the break, I was talking to a gentleman about the digital divide. The digital divide is a concern that you heard a lot about it about 10 years ago, about the poor not having access to technology. Technology is solving the digital divide by making cell phones really cheap and ubiquitous. And I understand that cell phone penetration in Chile is very close to 100%. Today, those cell phones are not internet devices by and large. But the iPhone has arrived, and I have one, maybe some of you do as well. The iPhone is a broadband access device to the internet. The last generation of cell phones were controlled by cell phone carriers, and there was no room for the long tail. The iPhone is controlled by Apple, and there is room for anything that can be found on the web. So basically, we are crossing the digital divide by making technology cheap and easy and ubiquitous. That is what 3 can do. Today, in fact, some cell phones are free. You pay for the minutes, but at any rate, they're cheap and getting cheaper. So that is the first technology, like electricity, because processing touches as much of our life today as electricity, maybe not quite as much, but a lot of the economy, and it's getting cheaper by half every 2 years. The second technology that's like electricity that's becoming too cheap to meter is storage. I'm going to tell you a story from my own life. Maybe this will ring a bell with you. Every morning when I go into my office and I pick up my phone on my desk, it tells me that I've got a lot of voicemail messages. And then it tells me that I've got too many voicemail messages. In fact, my voicemail box is full. And then I need to delete some voicemail messages. And around the office, many of my staff are doing the exact same thing. So Monday morning, or maybe one Monday a month, we spend time deleting voicemail messages. And so one day I was wondering, you know, a voicemail message, by the way, is about 16K of data. One day I was wondering, I wonder how much storage we have in our company. Let me calibrate this for you. A terabyte of storage is 1,000 gigabytes. A terabyte of storage right now costs about $120. If you buy a new desktop computer, a new Dell computer, you can get a terabyte of storage. It's just an option. I recently bought a new computer for my children. I've got lots of small children, and they like to do stop motion animation. They basically take Lego figures and they animate them very slowly and do Lego Star Wars scenes. You know, takes a, you know, all these images, takes some data. So we just got a terabyte of storage. We got a terabyte of storage in my children's computer. Again, a terabyte is 1,000 gigabytes. So I go to work the next morning and I ask my IT manager how much storage we have for my entire company. And the answer is 500 gigabytes. My children have twice as much storage as my entire company. Again, a terabyte costs $120. How did this happen? How did my company end up getting stuck thinking that storage was expensive when my children know that storage is free? That's a good question. And the answer is that when we grow up thinking of something as expensive and it becomes cheap, maybe even free, it's very hard to switch gears. It's very hard to think of it differently. However, if you grew up thinking that it is free, it's very easy to see what you might do with it. Although our IT managers are still conserving storage and treating it like it's expensive, there are lots of companies online who know better. Yahoo is one of them. And today, Yahoo Mail offers infinite storage for free. Infinite email capacity for free forever. How do they do that? Well, every year, the cost of offering infinite storage falls by 50%. And every year, the amount of money they can make from that, through advertising or something else, grows. It grows both with the number of users they have, and it grows with the increasing sophistication we have in marketing to people online. So the costs go down, and the revenues go up. Sooner or later, it's going to be free, and Yahoo got there first. So storage touches as much of the economy as processing does. Everything, you know, the internet has storage at its core, and that's becoming cheaper even faster than processing. That's number two. Number three is bandwidth. What's interesting about these three technologies is they're all based on entirely different physical principles. Processing is based on basically semiconductor physics, which is quantum mechanics. Storage is based on little heads flying over magnetic disks, which is about mechanics, just standard mechanics. And bandwidth is based on photons going through glass. It's based on light. Totally different physics, and yet each one of them is falling in price by 50% between 2 years and 1 year. As a matter of fact, bandwidth is falling in price even faster. So how does bandwidth touches again every bit of our economy? How does reducing bandwidth change things? This picture won't mean anything to you because I hope that this particular show called Everybody Loves Raymond is not made in Chile. Oh gosh, I'm so sorry. So Everybody Loves Raymond is an artifact of limited distribution. It's an artifact of scarce bandwidth. Everybody Loves Raymond is a one-size-fits-all program that is based on what we were talking about before, which is the need to reach mass audiences. The good thing about broadcast is that it costs nothing. The bad thing about broadcast is that there's very little of it. As a result, your channels need, every show you put on broadcast has to reach an audience of millions. And when you have to reach an audience of millions, you must focus on commonalities of taste rather than the differences of taste. The problem with commonalities of taste is that where our tastes agree is on really dumb stuff. We like lowbrow sitcoms. Basically, we like 30 minutes of sort of mildly funny shows with domestic themes and happy endings and likable characters. The things that we disagree on are the things that we like the best. This is the reason why cult television never succeeds in broadcast, is because the cult stuff, people love the cult stuff, but not everybody does. And the cult stuff you like is not the cult stuff that I like. So Everybody Loves Raymond is actually Nobody Loves Raymond. Everybody likes Raymond. This is the curse of broadcast. And this is what happens when you only have 5 or 10 channels. This is Lonely Girl 15. She is a creature of YouTube. Lonely Girl 15 is a viral video hit. She was apparently a 15-year-old girl being homeschooled in Utah, and she was lonely. And she would basically have a video diary, 3 minutes, and it was extremely popular. It was very interesting. People found it very interesting to find out what her life was like. At her peak, she was as popular as Raymond. Now, it turned out that she was actually basically a creation of two aspiring filmmakers, and she was an actress, but it doesn't matter. Well, the point is that YouTube had room for her, and YouTube had room for everything, and YouTube had room for bad television as well as good television. As a matter of fact, YouTube had room for mostly bad television, and YouTube let you waste bandwidth for whatever reason you wanted. It costs nothing, and there were no limits on what you put on YouTube. In the broadcast world of television, there is a committee of guys in suits who decide what can get on television and what cannot, based on mass appeal. On YouTube, there is no committee whatsoever. Everything gets on television, whether they like it or not. YouTube wastes television. Now, what's fascinating about this is that, again, we think of this as bad thing. It's a bad thing. I hear all the time, YouTube is full of crap. Everyone says, but isn't YouTube full of crap? And the answer is yes. And that's what makes it so fantastic. We are stuck in scarcity thinking. We are stuck thinking that television has to be good to get distribution. And the truth is, it doesn't have to be. Television can be bad and still get distribution. You don't have to watch it, but it can still get out there. Now, let me give you an example of what waste can do. Nature wastes life. Nature is full of waste. Take a dandelion, for example. A dandelion, when it spreads its seeds, spreads thousands of seeds, hundreds of seeds, and most of them die. But maybe one of them will land in a better place to grow a dandelion. Nature wastes life to find better life. When a bluefin tuna lays eggs, it'll lay 3 million eggs. Maybe 3 of them will grow up to become tunas. 2,900,000 and whatever eggs will die for the sake of 1 or 2 or maybe 3 tunas that will make it to adulthood. Nature is full of death. Nature is red in tooth and claw. Nature wastes life because in spreading its life far and wide, it will find new niches where life might improve. In the course of trying every possibility, every possible ecosystem, that's how you find the new ecosystems that are even better than the ecosystem you're in. What YouTube is the dandelion approach to television. Every video that can be made will be made. Every filmmaker who can exist will exist. Every variation of what television can be will be tried because it costs nothing to do so. That's what waste can do. What waste is doing is basically exploring the potential space of the future of television. We are discovering collectively what television will be tomorrow. And I can guarantee you it will not be what television was yesterday. Maybe it'll be 3 minutes. Maybe it'll be car crashes. I don't know. But what I do know is that we're going to figure it out together because no one's stopping us. And that's what free bandwidth allows. So the internet is basically the combination of these three technologies: processing, storage, and bandwidth. All three of which are falling in price. And what that means is that everything that goes online is bound to fall in price at the same speed. Now, we've never in history had this situation. In the 20th century, this is the work. This is the economy of atoms. The economy of the atoms is the economy we're living in right now. Physical stuff. Physical stuff gets more expensive. Tends to get more expensive over time. It's got inflation. Salaries go up, etc. In the world of atoms, in the economy of atoms, things get more expensive. But in the economy of bits, as the digital world, things get cheaper. We've never had an economy before where things get cheaper every year. It's a deflationary economy, not an inflationary economy. And in a deflationary economy, you need to treat it differently. In an inflationary economy, traditional economics works, choice under scarcity. In a deflationary economy, we don't have scarcity anymore, we have abundance. If you don't have infinite bandwidth today, you will have it tomorrow, and so on. This requires an entirely new way of thinking. Forgive me, that was not supposed to happen. Okay, here's a little bit of economics for you. An economist in the 18th century, named Bertrand, postulated that this sentence: in a competitive market, price falls to the marginal cost. Now, there were two reasons why no one took Bertrand seriously. First of all, there were no competitive markets in the 19th century, in the 1850s. Maybe you would have two butchers across from each other. You might have two shoe stores across from each other, but you didn't have a true competition. It was a choice between monopolies and cartels. That is changing. The internet is the most competitive market the world has ever seen. The barriers to entry and on the internet are close to zero. As a result, for the first time in history, we have a truly competitive market everywhere online. The seventh reason no one took Bertrand very seriously is because this point, price falls to the marginal cost, wasn't very interesting because the marginal cost was some number. So if you could imagine a truly competitive market for shoes, where the price falls to the marginal cost, and the marginal cost is $10, and the shoes would cost $10.10 or $10.20. You know, okay, still a price. But now apply this online. We have the most competitive market the world's ever seen, and we have a marginal cost of zero. So what Bertrand's rule says is that not only is the price of zero possible online, the price of zero is inevitable online. Everything online will go to free. It is the law. It is the force of gravity in the digital economy that everything online will go to free. You're familiar with this phrase, information wants to be free. Well, it's true. If the marginal cost of transmitting information online is zero, then sooner or later somebody is going to charge zero for it. And you can try to stop it with laws and copyrights, and you can try to stop it with copy protection, digital rights management, you know, that kind of stuff. But sooner or later, somebody's going to get around it. It might be a pirate who gets around it by just breaking the law, or it might be a competitor who gets around it by finding a clever way to do the same thing for free, such as open source software. So what this is a really, if you're in business today, this is a really scary sentence, because this sentence says that sooner or later, you're going to compete with free. The message for those of us who are in business is that we need to stop acting like our IT guys. We need to stop assuming that what we do is expensive and cannot be replicated. Instead, assume that it's going to be free. And the question is, can we get free first? Can we round down to zero and sell something else? So what else might you sell? Now, here's the last sort of rule from economics. One of the principles you learn in your first year of economics is that every abundance creates a new scarcity. Basically, as one thing becomes abundant, value moves to the next level up, where things are still scarce. So in the world where information and, you know, bits are abundant, what's scarce? Well, we still have time. We all still have 24 hours in the day. And we still have money. Money's still scarce. Now we have two new scarcities. One's attention, and the other is reputation. These are non-monetary economies. And basically what's happening online today is the monetary economy is becoming free, and we're creating these new economies built around the new scarcities of attention and reputation. And the trick is to somehow convert from one to the other. This is how we do it. In the attention economy, we measure attention with the units of web traffic, and we convert web traffic into money with advertising. That's pretty easy. In the reputation economy, we also have a currency. It's called the incoming link, the hyperlink. We measure that the way Google does with PageRank. The higher your PageRank is, basically the more incoming links you have, the higher your PageRank is, and the higher your PageRank is, the higher your site will come in search, in organic search. The higher your site comes in organic search, the more traffic that search will generate, and the more traffic you get, the more money you can make via ads. So there it is. These are the kind of currency conversion tables of the 21st century, that we turn attention and reputation into money via these mechanisms. But there's more. There are other ways to make money from free. I'm just going to leave this up here. This is actually the article we wrote in Wired earlier this year. This is also the subject of the book. But I want to leave a little time before Q&A. So I'm just going to not show you pictures, but instead talk about some of the ways you can think about to make money from free. So again, we have the 21st century free is really free. It's not a trick anymore. But now the underlying costs are falling to zero. When the underlying costs fall to zero, you can do something very different. You can give away most of your product to sell a little bit. In the traditional world of free samples, you would give away a tiny fraction of your muffins or your perfume to sell the rest. You give away 1% to sell 99%. In the digital economy, where the costs are zero, you can give away 99% to sell 1%. This is called freemium. It's free plus premium. And what you do is you basically offer a free version to most people and then offer an upgrade path to a paid version for the people who value it the most. These are your most committed customers, and these are the ones who are price insensitive. These are the ones who are happy to pay because they understand the value of what you're offering. You see this right now in the video game industry, which is fascinating. The video game industry is moving from a world of a packaged good, a box that you would sell for $50, to a online service. So now you have games, World of Warcraft, EverQuest, etc. Second Life, I suppose, is a game of sorts. The games are free. World of Warcraft isn't, but most of these others are. The game is free. What they're selling is an upgrade path. In the Second Life, the game is free, but you buy the land. In other games, you'll buy, upgrades. You'll buy armor or clothing or new levels or time savers, things like that. The video game industry is moving from paid to free, and yet they're still making money. And they're making money by using free to reach the maximum possible audience and then converting a tiny fraction of them to paid users. This was never possible before. It's only possible when your marginal cost of serving the majority who don't pay are zero. But yet that is the smartest business model of the moment. And the question for all companies is, how can you adopt this model? How can you find a way to give away what you do for free to sell something else? And I suspect that we're already seeing it happen in services where, jobs like travel agent and stockbroker and tax accountant are now being done by software. And the moment something's done by software, it immediately becomes possible to make it free, and sooner or later somebody will make it free. And to watch those industries find something else to sell is fascinating, and I think a glimpse of the future that we're all going to have to navigate. So with that, I wanted to leave a little time for questions. I think there's a lot more to talk about at Free. As you can imagine, I'm 3 weeks away from my deadline on my book, you'll be the first to hear where this is all going. So thank you very much for that, and I'll take questions.
En realidad, con solo saber ese cambio de sexo. Las preguntas.
¿Está funcionando la traducción para el inglés? No bien. Es extraño. ¿Ahora sí? ¿Te traduce? Perfecto. Bueno, lo bueno es que el que reparte se lleva la mejor parte, así que tengo la oportunidad de hacer una pregunta. Eso es bien bueno. Y también Andrés de la universidad y la María Olivia de la revista Poder y Negocios.
El humor no es
y luego vamos a abrir, tengo entendido que va a haber gente con micrófonos, o por lo menos así espero, y voy a tratar de ser más o menos equitativa en la repartición. Tenemos por lo menos una media horita para conversar y hacerle las preguntas a Chris. Prometo no preguntarte cómo va el libro, porque leí en tu blog que esa es la pregunta que más te molesta por estos días, así que no voy a hablar de cómo va el libro ni de qué se trata el libro. Pero aquí probablemente en la audiencia tenemos gente que está en la economía digital y que quiere preguntar desde ese mundo y cómo crecer desde la economía digital. Y hay gente como yo, yo trabajo en televisión abierta, por lo tanto después de escucharte estoy muy asustada sobre lo que puede venir para mi futuro. Y te quiero preguntar desde ese mundo, desde el mundo de la economía real, que si bien está online, está en el mundo digital, todavía es física, ¿verdad? Te quiero preguntar por tu experiencia en Wired, porque tú caminas en esa delgada línea de trabajar en una revista de papel que, sin embargo, funciona con temas digitales. Una revista que cuando tú llegaste ahí le estaba yendo pésimo, venía recién de explotar la burbuja de Internet, y Chris Anderson la tiró nuevamente para arriba y y desde ese punto también, desde ese punto de vista también fue muy exitosa. Pero es que esto que tú hablas de mantenerte en el nicho, pero ser masivo como revista y competir con este ejército de hormigas, ¿cómo lo manejas tú particularmente desde Wired?
Good question. So we do all of this. We do everything I've talked about. When it comes to the long tail, in the magazine, we pay writers $3 a word to make these perfect fabricates, this perfect thing. And we hope for the best. We try to make the blockbusters. Online, we have bloggers who are amateurs. We have a site called Reddit, which is a user-generated news and voting service. Most of our content today is generated for free by the amateurs. In the magazine, we charge a subscription price. Online, it's free. In the magazine, we only have room for one size fits all.
Parenthesis. Why would anybody buy the magazine if you get all the content for free? Same with your book, by the way, because you're putting most of the content of your new book online now.
Yeah. So people ask me all the time, is print dead? And I'm like, which print do you mean? Newspapers? Probably newspapers as a physical. As print, newspapers are probably going to die. But there's other kinds of print. There's weekly magazines. They're struggling. There's monthly magazines. Monthly magazines do something that the internet cannot do. Monthly magazines are 8,000 word articles with are packaged in design photography. Nobody wants to read 8,000 words online. The photography turns into thumbnails. The design is gone. The packaging of ideas is very difficult to translate online. So when you say that our content is available online, it's not really about content. You can read the words, but you won't get to the end of the story, and you can't combine it with the packaging. So then there's books. Books are also very, very hard to do, very hard to read on the screen. So books are another kind of print that still has life. So the point is that the internet is very good for breadth, but very bad at depth. The internet is a very bad way to read 8,000 words with graphics and design. And that is why a monthly magazine has depth, still has a place. And that's why all of our magazines, which are monthly, are doing very well in a world where newspapers are doing very bad. And as for the books, why do I keep my book wave online? Because I believe in physical books. I think of the physical book as a superior form. I think that it's a freemium model, right? I give away the inferior free version so that some fraction of the people who sample it online will buy the superior version. There are other models, but that's basically it.
You can take it to the bathroom too. I was not thinking about books, but about magazines, for instance. you won't take the computer, I guess, to that place. You do. Pero yo no. No, pero hay algo que tiene que ver con la portabilidad, obviamente, del formato físico, que todavía no es superado por el formato digital, por mucho que no lo ande trayendo la plante y qué sé yo.
Well, that has to protect protected newspapers. I mean, you can take a newspaper to the bathroom, but it hasn't stopped them from going down the drain.
Yeah, sí, de
En español. Muere Walmart, la gente que está en los hits, los negocios que están en los hits, van decreciendo, tienden a desaparecer. ¿Qué pasa cuando la cola larga es más grande que la primera parte?
I mean, first of all, that's the most misunderstood aspect of the long tail. Everyone thought it was the end of the blockbuster. And it's not.
You have to switch.
Oh. How have people been hearing me? I see. Everyone thinks the long tail is the end of the blockbuster, and it's not. What it is, it's the end of the monopoly of of the blockbuster. The 20th century, there was only room for blockbusters and nothing else. The 21st century, the world we're in right now, has room for blockbusters and everything else. And so as a result, we're figuring out what is the right balance between one size fits all and one size fits one. In some industries, blockbusters will continue to be very strong. I think, sports. In sports or something, we it's a very, national teams, very kind of, actually, no, that's a bad example. It's a terrible example, because we follow national sports, but we also follow our children. My children's soccer games are not shown on television, and yet I'm more interested in my children's soccer games than I am in the games that are shown on television. So we'll figure it out. But basically, the market now divides between hits and niches, and the hits lose some market share, and the niches gain market share, but different markets will have different balances.
Yo vuelvo a los medios de comunicación, sobre todo a la revista. Nosotros tenemos una revista nueva y nuestra preocupación, sobre todo en un mercado como el chileno, que es un mercado chico, competitivo, y que nos interesa hacer un periodismo con un grado más de profundidad en este mercado de la creatividad. ¿Quién paga esto? ¿El modelo de alguna forma de los avisajes tradicional que ya conocemos? ¿O de alguna forma también tenemos la posibilidad social con los negocios? ¿Qué ideas nos dan?
¿Será comprensión o en dónde estuvo la última hora?
We're still trying to work that out. I'll give you the numbers of my own business. I have two businesses. I have a print business, which reaches about 2 million people, and I have an online business that reads about 180 million page views, about 12 million people. 2 million, 12 million. The business that reaches 2 million people is 5 times larger than the business that reaches 12 million people. Because, advertisers pay more for that form of engagement. It's considered to have more impact than a banner ad on a website. But the website business is growing faster. And right now the difference is 5 times. My business is 5 times larger. The print business is 5 times larger than the online business. Maybe in 3 years' time, it'll be 2 times. Maybe someday it'll be equal. Google today is reinventing advertising. It has managed to turn advertising from a market where you annoy most of the people most of the time to one where, by targeting the ad correctly, so it's the right ad on the right content, maybe you don't annoy anybody at all. I did a survey recently on I have a robotics company. I did a survey on the site. I asked people whether they want to take the ads off or not. These are Google ads. The ads are so perfectly targeted that people don't even see the ads. They thought they were content. They said, what ad? Yeah. So I think the answer is that we are going to see, just in the same way you see a shift from the hits to the niches, we're going to see a shift from the kind of untargeted advertising that annoys most people to a targeted advertising that doesn't. But I still think there's a place for, we own Vogue magazine, right? Vogue magazine is mostly about the ads. People buy it for the ads. So there is definitely a place for that kind of advertising as far as we can see, but it's not going to be the only one.
Hello. Chris, thanks very much for your interesting presentation. My name is Harold Balik Freeman, and I'm teaching here at the School of Engineering. And I was actually thinking of buying your book. I was wondering if you will explain some detail in your upcoming book one issue that has been very relevant in this transition that is taking place, when you say that things that used to be very scarce are becoming very abundant. But on the other hand, especially for the internet, things that we were not very aware of are becoming very scarce, like attention. And if I look at companies like Google, which solve a very fundamental problem, namely finding stuff on the web very rapidly, this is nothing new. I mean, we had companies in the past, maybe 10 years ago, even 15 years ago, who were doing just that. I mean, if you think of companies like AltaVista, for example. Now, something happened along the way which made search such an interesting proposition. Namely, like you said in your presentation, volumes of content, more users getting online, ubiquitous access to bandwidth, on the other hand, made these abundance of information so big that people were trying to get information very fast. So my question is, attention is of the essence, capturing attention is of the essence. So are you going to elaborate in your book what sets of technologies and applications will capture that very fundamental feature which I call end user value? So capturing end user value will in the coming years be absolutely of the essence. And my question to you is, what are the applications and the technologies that will drive that capturing of end user attention, end user value as I call it, in order to drive value and ignite the next revolution, the next revenue models?
I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint you. No, that's not going to be in the book. That was the last. That's what the long tail is. And the long tail is the way you capture attention by being able to address individual needs. There's no, you know, I assure you that, you know, that in the world of news right now, the news that my daughter has fallen on the playground and hurt her knee is much more interesting to me than anything that can happen in Iraq. I'm sorry to say it's true, say that, but it's true. The news that is relevant to me, involving my world, is more important than any other news. That's how you capture attention, is by addressing minority taste. Free is about business models built around that. I'm not going to tell anybody how to capture attention in free. I will tell them how to monetize the attention, and also to build a framework. We talk about the attention economy, the reputation economy, but we don't really treat it like an economy. We don't quantify it. We don't figure out what the conversion rates are, what the calculus of reputation and attention is. And so what the book will do is treat attention and reputation like real economies, recognizing that non-monetary economies are as important as monetary economies online.
Christian Johnson de la Exclusive Business. La creencia común es que un sistema de libre mercado, un sistema donde las economías crecen, las implicancias naturales son una oferta cada vez mayor de bienes, donde cada consumidor satisface sus propias necesidades. ¿Podría ser verdad la siguiente hipótesis, que esta historia del long tail es básicamente una transición que existe entre unas economías emergentes donde hay una escasez de bienes hacia el futuro, donde vamos a tener a cada uno de los consumidores satisfaciendo cada una de sus necesidades? Por lo tanto, vamos a tener en realidad una especie de flat tail o ninguna tail, ¿no? No usted ahora. O sea, quizás en el futuro el libro de la extensión natural que podría existir sería flat theory. La segunda pregunta bien cortita es que supongamos que aquí hay una teoría más que una recopilación de hechos de transición. ¿Cuál es la historia que nos cuenta esta teoría respecto de lo que va a pasar con las carreras en las universidades? Estamos en el tema de la universidad. Estamos pensando quizás que en el futuro estamos hablando de educación gratis.
Yeah, good questions. I actually get that question a lot about free education, possibly to the state universities. So I'll address that one, and then I'll try to remember. Right. Okay. So first, the education one. I mean, it's very interesting. That experiment in free education is happening right now. MIT has put their entire curriculum online for free. It's called OpenCourseWare. Stanford's now done the same thing. There's a couple more universities. I think basically almost all universities are going to put their entire curriculum online for free. Which raises the question, what business is a university in? I guess you're a professor. Let's pretend you're a professor. So he is a professor. So you are in the business of coming up with a curriculum, a reading list, picking a reading list. You're in the business of giving lectures. So all of that can easily be done for free, right? Put it online. Stanford puts the YouTube videos of the professors. So all that kind of stuff is basically a one-way conversation. You make the decisions. You talk. The students listen. And they can listen in their classroom or they can listen remotely. Doesn't matter. But that's not all a university is. A university is also two other things. One of them is the individual conversations you have with the student that you mentor, you help, etc. And the even more important one is the conversations the students have with each other. So why do people come to this room? I mean, you can watch my videos online. Why come to this room? You partly come to this room, I don't know, it's a better way to listen to somebody, but you also come to the room to meet each other. And it's also free. I think that what universities are is really an opportunity to have a kind of a mixing pot of ideas and people who build relationships both with their professors and each other that will last them the rest of their life. And that unique ability to select people who will mix well is what universities do today and will increasingly do tomorrow. The other part, the lecturing, the reading list, etc., that's free. That's not university. Your second, the first question was about the, you know, as we become increasingly capable of creating our own goods and services, you know, do markets disappear? I mean, it's true, we are getting increasingly able to make our own goods and services, but the reality is most of us don't. I mean, I can make my own operating system, but I don't. You know, I can make my own movies, but I don't. I can make my own music, but I don't. Instead, because I'm bad at those things. Instead, I find people who are better at those things, and I pay them to do it for me. Sometimes I pay them with money, sometimes I pay them with attention, sometimes I pay them with reputation. You know, we understand basic economics, right? It's division of labor, right? Ricardo who had the original concept of different nations having different skills, and different people have different skills as well. So there will always be somebody better at doing something than you, and that person now has an opportunity to reach you, and in that exchange is an opportunity to create a market. So I think there will always be markets, but the markets will be more broadly distributed. But we're not going to. It's not going to be back to the days of the Stone Age, where we all hunted our own food and carved our own hides and built our own houses. I think we're past that.
No, pero le llamaron, ¿no?
My name is Philip Horden. Chris, here I am here. Thank you very much for your presentation. I've been following your long tail theory for quite a while, mainly in the entertainment area. You mentioned very briefly about piracy, and the long tail also crosses over many issues of intellectual property. Could you give some comments on how you see the two areas of the free economy and intellectual property working together?
This is where I get in trouble.
That's why I asked the question.
Yeah.
So I'm going to answer you honestly and ask you to try to understand how these contradictions can be. By day, I work for Disney and Condé Nast. We protect copyright. By night, I reject copyright. I personally don't believe in intellectual property. I don't think it's necessary. I give away. Everything I do privately, I give away. And then I make money around it. So my book, for example, Free, is going to be free in every way possible. The audiobook, MP3 download. The ebook is going to be free download. The web version, just like in my magazine, is going to be free. The marginal cost is zero, so the price is going to be zero. One of the physical forms is going to be sponsored. and three, and the sponsorship is just going to cover the distribution costs. I renounce copyright on all of it. I want people to steal it. It would make me so happy if I found out that some Chinese pirate had printed up millions of copies and distributed around the world. And the reason why is that I'm not in the books business. I'm going to be completely honest about this. I'm not in the business of selling books. And this is going to sound horrible, but it probably won't translate well, but I'm in the business of selling me. I'm in the business of distributing my ideas as far as wide as possible to create celebrity, personal celebrity. And I will convert that celebrity into money one way or another. And, and you know, there's a whole chapter. There's a chapter that is in China. In China, piracy is basically unstoppable. They've given up on intellectual property in China. And as a result, the music industry is stopped by it. And so what musicians do in China is they let their music be pirated. And they use that piracy as a form of free distribution that creates celebrity. And then they turn that celebrity into money via things like concerts, personal appearances, endorsements, commercials, and things like that. So that's what free does. Free allows you to spread whatever you've got as far and wide as possible. And intellectual property protections stand in the way of distributing free ideas. So that's my philosophy. As I said, my employers all disagree with me. So watch how we handle this.
Hello. Hola, mi nombre es Juan Pablo Guiso. Agradezco tu presentación. Mi pregunta es la siguiente. ¿Encuentras tú que hay algún cambio entre lo que se siente y lo que se piensa en una economía convencional con esta economía de sentar puntos de gratuidad?
Try to answer that. I mean, the big difference between the Adams economy of the 20th century and the Bits economy of the 21st century is that free is fake in one and real in the other. Right? Free is a trick, a marketing trick in the Adams economy because the marginal cost of not to be cheap. Someone's got to pay this cost. There's no such thing as free lunch. In the Bits economy, free doesn't have to be a trick. So I think that's, you know, I mean, the word gratis has negative connotations. You know, and for good reason. And I think that for the generation free, for the kids who are growing up online today, they don't have negative connotations. They're not suspicious of free. They understand the economics of digital distribution intuitively. They understand that things should be free. This is the reason why people pirate music online, because it's a victimless crime. Because they realized that there was no cost there that comes out of somebody else's pocket. That, I think, is the change in attitude between the two models.
The problem is that the papás pagan the parents pay for the bill. I mean, because you never take into consideration that somebody has to pay for the broadband bill at the end of the month. It's usually the parents or the university, they don't pay the university fees as well. I know it's a very marginal thing, but still, there is a cost. And then I'm going to give the... Sorry, I interrupted. But there's going to be one more last question over there.
That point that you just made, I hear all the time, that's actually a mistake. So what you're paying for... So when you get a phone line, you pay for the access, but you don't pay for the content. So the mistake people make by saying that because you're paying for the services online because you're paying for your access, that's the mistake of saying, like, I'm paying for the value I get from my phone, from the conversations based on my phone bill. We have the bits that travel over the internet and then the line itself. Two different markets. You're paying for the line. The bits can have zero value or maximum value, completely unrelated.
Estoy de acuerdo que la plata va a personas diferentes. The money goes to different people, to different companies. but at the same time, the personal experience, la experiencia personal, for the customer is that you have to pay to get internet access, so you have to pay for the content.
No.
No. Okay, no. He disagrees.
No. Ella es del siglo pasado.
Sí. Porque no, se nos está cortando el tiempo y no quiero monopolizar la conversación. Había una pregunta. Había una pregunta que había pedido ahí a alguien.
Max Campino.
Ah, eras tú, según yo, pero no eres. Okay. Es la última, tengo entendido, dice el rector.
Mi pregunta es si hoy en día, según lo que tú explicas, una línea de banda ancha o acceso a internet va a ser como tener una cuenta bancaria. En ese contexto, ¿quiénes van a ser los pobres del mundo de free? Porque hoy en día los pobres en gran medida son aquellos que no tienen acceso a crédito, por ejemplo en África, incluso aquí en Latinoamérica, en muchos países. Entonces, ¿cómo ves tú un poco ese modelo y cómo se va a dar?
Buena pregunta.
Yeah, I mean, I talked a little bit about that in the speech. I mean, this is the digital divide question again. Technology gets cheaper. I spent the 1990s in China and in India. Right? China and India, basically 1 billion people got cell phones collectively. That's digital. I mean, the reason the 1 billion people got cell phones is because cell phones got so cheap that Indians and Chinese could have them. So, I mean, you know, if this problem hasn't been solved today, and it hasn't been solved today, it will be solved tomorrow. You know, 10 years, 20 years from now, that you will have, you know, pretty much everybody have some access to information, digital information. Sometimes it will be cell phones, sometimes it will be very low cost, you know, other devices. Sometimes it's going to be done by WiMAX or other sort of forms of open spectrum. Some of it's going to be done as a business, some of it's going to be done as a charity, some of it's going to be done by governments. We're going to solve this problem. As again, you know, the experience of living in the developing world for the 90s and watching 1 billion people come out of poverty while I lived there tells me what can happen in a short period of time. And I think that all these forces I've talked about the falling price of technology, basically are the best way to reach the poor that we've ever seen. So I'm very confident we're going to get there.
Por acá, ¿aló? Hola, mi nombre es Andrés Israel y trabajo con Publimetro, un diario gratuito. Y quería volver al tema un poco de los medios escritos o la prensa. La pregunta es, en 5 años más, ¿cómo vamos a ver los medios, en particular la prensa, y cuál es su opinión de los diarios gratuitos en el mundo? Sabiendo que hoy en día, 1 de 4 diarios que se reparten en el mundo o se venden son gratuitos. Gracias.
Thank you for asking that, because it's a more interesting question than people realize. I basically have two or three answers for you. First of all, what is a newspaper? Is a newspaper the act of journalism, reporting and writing and propagating information, or is a newspaper the paper? I think the paper part is probably going to go away over time. The rest, the act of journalism of reporting and writing and communicating and understanding your audience, that's completely valid. Now, today, almost all newspapers are free already. Now, most of them are only free online. The physical form still has a price. But, as you mentioned, there are more and more free physical newspapers as well. And when you think about it, newspapers have always been free in one way or another, which is like, at least in the United States, you get newspapers in a box on the street corner, and you put in 25 cents or 50 cents, and you open the door, and you can take as many newspapers as you want. You can take a whole stack. And the reason that they let you take a whole stack is that they're not selling newspapers. They're selling audiences to advertisers. The fact that you paid to open the door suggests that you really want that newspaper, and you're able to charge the advertiser more because that reader is qualified by having paid a price. Free newspapers that never charge can't charge as much to the advertiser because the readers have not expressed their interest that way. So, and nevertheless, free newspapers are a good way to reach the generation that's growing up online and expects everything to be free. So I think that basically that you're going to have two worlds of newspapers. There's lots of journalism that isn't newspapers, and we can talk about that as well, but there's going to be two kinds of newspapers. There's basically going to be very big national dailies, which have a print edition for old people and an online edition for young people. You're going to have free dailies for young people because print still has some advantages of portability. And then you're going to have online experiences that tend to be more local, less national news and more sort of community news, often generated by the community themselves, not by journalists. I think that, I don't know whether that's a bigger industry or a smaller industry today. It's probably a smaller industry. And so I think the industry will shrink, but there still will be a role for that industry. And the fact that journalists will go from writers to more editors and coaching the community to write their own story is an interesting transition I think we're all trying to work through right now. But I'm broadly positive and optimistic about journalism as a function, and very pessimistic about the traditional forms we have of distributing journalism today.
Bueno, agradecerle a Chris una vez más y a todos ustedes por esta mañana.